It's all in. Okay. So you moved to... My secret. Well, we'll see if it works. It may be the battery, may be good, but this will work too.
Okay. Going? Yeah.
So you're gonna have to speak up.
Okay. So
you were, how long were you in New York?
About 8 years.
Yeah.
And I was struggling with the lifestyle wasn't doing it for me. Just day to day. I grew up in the woods.
Where?
In northwest Connecticut, just under the Berkshires, in Canton. You know Canton?
I don't know Canton, but I'm originally from Ludlow, Mass, between Springfield and Ann Arbor, so I understand.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, I went to school in Boston. Boston's nice. I moved down here, and this is where all the great musicians are, but I just couldn't get with the day-to-day.
Yeah.
So I moved to Barcelona for a couple different reasons.
Uh-huh.
I was there for a year or two, and there was really nobody to play with.
Uh-huh.
So I moved back to Boston and got another degree, and I've just been up there for about a little over 4 years.
What'd you get a degree in, second time?
Just a master's in music.
Master's in music, where?
At New England Conservatory.
At New England, yeah, cool.
That's where I did my undergrad, too.
Yeah.
So, and I'm tired of Boston now. So I think I'm moving back.
To New York?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never lived in Boston, even though I'm a native Massachusetts guy.
Boston's really nice. It's easy. It's manageable. So,
yeah.
It's just, I feel like things are slipping musically.
Really?
And not feeling inspired whatsoever.
Well, it's amazing because you've got, you're prolific. You've got 3 albums coming out this year, right?
Yeah, I just started today recording my 15th.
15th
record, yeah.
As a leader.
Yeah.
Yeah. You started recording today?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
Awesome. I'm more excited about this record than any other record I've ever associated with.
Well, you're going to have to keep in touch. We should talk either later this week or whenever to go into more detail because you're working with...
For this one.
Yeah.
This is a guy named Steve Lampert.
I heard your interview.
Oh, you listened to the interview?
Yeah, he sounded really interesting.
He's really inspiring.
And he wrote all this music for you.
Yeah. It's serious. It's the hardest saxophone melody I've ever played in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's also got layers of things going back and forth. Tell me about that.
So he wrote this one piece. It's in essentially 13 different sections, but it's one piece. I mean, he's a student of like Elliot Carter and a lot of contemporary classical artists. And but he was a trumpet player. I mean, you heard the interview. He played with Mulligan and
yeah.
I mean, so the music is a mishmash of synths, electronic stuff. It's essentially two bands. It's an electronic band and an acoustic band. And the acoustic group is killing. It's with Chris Davis, Rudy Royston, the bass player Kim Cass. John O'Gallagher playing alto player.
Don't know him.
He's my favorite saxophone player in the world.
Oh, yeah?
And Jason Palmer, trumpet player.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's based on, it's essentially a dream. Each one of these sections has this melody, which is ridiculous, and then a fantasy section, and then an open blowing section. And there's different groupings of musicians that blow together on these different sections. It's really, it's beautiful. It's really dense. really challenging. And man, it's like a dream come true.
So you have two different bands playing together at the same time?
We already mixed and mastered the electronics.
Uh-huh.
And so, like today, I wanted to go in early to record my melody, which is like, it's sick even for like a classical saxophonist. Uh-huh. It's really difficult. So I had to piece it together. Tomorrow, yeah, everyone else is showing up to get the ensemble stuff happening, uh-huh. the blowing. Uh-huh. So I'll send it to you when it's
ready to go. Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about it. It's hard for me to just talk about it. It would be great if you could give me some of the music, or else go into more detail about it, and maybe even talk to Steve.
I'm going to...
For a minute. Not long, because this piece is like... It's ridiculously 2,400 words. And so... And I'm already... I've known Jason since he started with Greg Osborne, so that'll work out fine. But again...
Who else are you talking to?
Jason Marin.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you.
Cool.
Otherwise, if I talk to too many people...
Right.
Lost.
Cool.
Unfortunately, I've left my glasses at home, so every once in a while to be specific, I'm going to have to go like this and just scope things out. But at any rate, so...
So I have that record, and then I did that Preminger record for Nouvelle Records.
Yeah, I've really been plowing into that.
He sent that over to you?
Yeah, not the record yet, but...
He didn't send the music over to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been listening, on the stream cloud or whatever.
Cool.
And what I did this afternoon was, I had a whole bunch of questions about it. Sucks, I should just put my... I don't want to send an emergency. How's that? Bunny Lake is missing. I watched that this afternoon.
Oh, really?
I'd never seen it before. And it was pretty remarkable. So tell me, before I go into that one specifically,
okay,
why Preminger plays Preminger?
So, he's a distant relative.
He is.
My great-grandfather and he were first cousins, supposedly. The people who know are dead, and there's no real way to know officially. But what my grandmother died last week, and she told me that she had always told me that my great-grandfather, Jack Preminger, and Otto were first cousins. They grew up together in a town called Czernowitz. And
Czernowitz in Austria, yeah?
Otto always lied. He had, in his autobiography, he said he was from Vienna, but he wasn't. He was from Czernowitz.
How do you spell it?
Czernowitz.
In Austria.
Romania? Or, I think.
I'll track it down. I'll find it. So there is a connection.
Yeah, I think borders changed. Maybe it was Romania now. I don't know. Anyway, so I never really had a great interest in Preminger's movies until I was a freshman in college.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with Rand Blake, pianist?
Yeah, sure, of course.
So Rand, who was at New England Conservatory in Boston, was waiting for me on the front steps of the New England Conservatory as a freshman. I was like 17 or 18. He was like, Noah, I've been waiting for you. I can't believe there's a Preminger at New England Conservatory. And he was so excited, and he was unbelievably disappointed when I told him that I wasn't really familiar with Otto's stuff. And so at that point, I checked out some Otto Preminger movies, but I didn't really have an interest. You know, I'm like 18, and I, you know, wanted to leave home and chill. You know, so. Over the years, I checked out some of his films, maybe six or seven, not a lot.
Uh-huh.
And then a few years back, I had this idea to... I wanted to score my own score my own auto films.
Uh-huh.
I thought that would be a nice project.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening is I got to go from the green light from Nouvelle,
uh-huh,
this record label. I picked my bands. I really love Jason Moran. I think he's really special.
Was the first time with him?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I think he's really special as a person, player, the whole thing. And so I wrote a lot of the music for him in mind. It was also my first time playing with Jesus. I always space on this fucking name. You know, Roy Haynes' grandkid,
Marcus Gilmore.
Yeah. My first time with him, too. So, and I love him. He's an orchestral player. I mean, he really tells a story, everything he does. So, I wrote this music for them, and I decided it would be neat to arrange the melodies, the four or five of them that I love. And so I sat down and watched maybe 15 of his movies. And picked out the songs I really liked, made a list and narrowed it down to four or five. And then the movies that maybe I didn't totally dig the soundtrack to, but there were some nice scenes that I liked, that were, you know, that had nice melodies, you know,
uh-huh,
the way people moved or, you know, I just hit mute and wrote for those. So the one you just mentioned, Bunny Lake.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember now. I have a sheet with all the time spots that I marked down. Bunny Lake, there's a scene near the end where somebody's ripping the kid away from the other person and they're on like a swing set or something.
Yeah.
So I hit mute and scored that. And that's where I came up with that melody. Yeah.
Because it really is a psycho thriller. It's really wild. Yeah, and the guy who's, you know, the swing thing is her brother, who got totally freaked out when she had a baby, and they no longer became brother and sister.
Right.
So there's all that psycho thriller and stuff, but your piece is so, it's kind of like, there's like a calmness to it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I tried to, it felt more haunting and calm. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
The haunting calm thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, tell me about the Ellington piece.
Oh, that's a fun one.
And then that, boy, Jason plays the hell out of that. That's what I'm going to talk to him about. Tell me about that.
I mean, that piece sounds like Jason, you know?
Yeah.
And he was familiar with it already. He knew that soundtrack. And so, you know, I didn't send them any of the music beforehand. And none of my records I've given the music to any of the cats,
uh-huh,
ever. No rehearsal, just show up in the studio and throw it in front of them. But he knew that one. Yeah, that Duke soundtrack is amazing.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that film?
I am, yeah. And I think that it came out as a record recording, right? A Duke recording. That I have a copy of, I believe. I'm going to go back home and find it tomorrow. But yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
You know, for me, I have a different approach to movies. I have a different approach to music with lyrics.
Uh-huh.
I have a hard time following a plot to films. I have a hard time. I couldn't tell you the words to a single song in its entirety.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's more about just the feeling that I get from it, and the overall. I don't know. Just sort of like from beginning to end, the story it tells just sonically,
uh-huh,
not lyrically.
Uh-huh.
So the films for me were just, it was fun. Like, this shit needs to be fun for me to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, because I can't do the, like, you know, I totally understand why Train ended where he ended. Because writing a bunch of chord changes and a melody and blowing on it, and then it's just, it's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't do it.
Yeah.
And then there's only a certain point that you can get to when you're blowing emotionally with the intensity. It's just, it stops at a certain point, like when you're screaming that loud. or it's that empty, you know, with that much space. It's just, that's it. That's the cutoff.
Uh-huh.
So there needs to be something else to it. And for me, it's like, I need to be passionate about the project,
uh-huh.
and for other reasons.
Uh-huh.
Which is why this Preminger record was a lot of fun for me. It was just, it was another idea. It was another concept. It was just another direction, something to do that was fun. This Steve Lampert record, this is why I'm so excited about it. Because it's so different than everything else going on in jazz.
Yeah.
And everything else.
Well, the way that you did your radio show kind of interspersing pieces of his music, I just went, wow, this is incredible. You know, like what he's doing with it and the different shapes and the different changes and different vibraphones in there.
You gotta understand with his music, the way he has this, you know, this composition, it doesn't just move forward.
Uh-huh.
It circles in and out like an eight.
Uh-huh.
The way that it moves sonically, the way the progressions move, it's, you know, I mean, it's cliche to say that it's like 12-tone bass and all this other shit, but it has layers that move, and then sonically it swirls around you. I mean, it's a different concept.
How did you get to know him? Boston guy?
No. He's a lifelong New Yorker. He came to a gig of mine. I did a trio gig with Ben Maunder and Jeff Hirschfield.
Uh-huh.
Probably like 8 years ago, 9 years ago, somewhere down here. And he came because he was friends with Jeff and knew Ben, playing sessions years ago, and hit it off, being friends. He's like one of my best friends. I love him.
Wow.
Yeah. Day special. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So go back to Preminger. I've got stuff.
Okay.
I have lots of notes here. So, one of the things I found was that there is a sense of storytelling in this music. That, you know, you may not be starting from point A to point C in the movie, but like you were saying, what you were just talking about, it's just like one scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you approach
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I mean, I was looking for the scene. So I'd watch, and if there was something that happens that I found to be, you know, noteworthy or beautiful, or I would write down that time marking, and then wait till the end of the scene or the end of the scenes, or just find that block and then watch it over and over and over again, and sit at the piano. I mean, I never write on the horn.
Uh-huh.
Sit at the piano and see if a melody will come to me, or a set of chords, or a shape, or anything, you know, some kind of an idea, a cell or something, and then just try to expand on that and try to imitate the mood of that scene.
Did you dig deep and find out who Otto Preminger was and what he was, his bombastic nature?
Yeah, he was a horrible person.
Yeah.
He treated women like shit.
Yeah.
Treated everybody around him poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing how he was able to pull this off.
Yeah. I don't think that would fly these days.
No, probably not.
Yeah.
What tune am I also interested in? Advising.
Oh, Advising Consent.
Yeah.
There was a scene in that film.
Yeah.
There was a scene in that film where there was like a, some sort of like judicial chamber or something.
Yeah.
Like a government building. And there was a scene where they went back and forth between this group of women who were dressed as nines, walking up, they walked inside, walked up these staircase, and they were like almost marching towards this like room, this chamber. And it went back and forth between them and these men, I don't know if they're like congressmen or lawyers or something, who looked kind of sneaky, suspect in the room. and it went back and forth from the women to the men. So I wrote these two different sections. One section was for the women, and one section was for the men. And we play the first section, which is to the women, and then we improvise on that section.
Uh-huh.
And then that segues to the next section, which is for the men in the chamber. And then I think I improvised on the first section, maybe. Jason blew over the second section. Something like that.
Yeah, it's open to sex.
Or maybe trumpet and tenor blew over the first section, guitar blew over the second section, something like that. But there were these two different sections pertaining to the men and the women, their attitudes. Yeah. Yeah. And they were like both kind of like these drone sections over different key tonal centers. So that one came straight to me immediately.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That never happens, man. It's wonderful.
What about Star Wars 17?
Oh, have you watched that film?
No, I haven't, but I want to. I used to watch Star Wars 13.
Oh, really?
Well, you know what that is.
No, I don't. What is that?
The sitcom with these. It was a sitcom, and it was with all these guys in Star Wars 13 who had a whole tunnel of things and all this stuff. And the commandant was crazy.
When is that from?
Oh, it was from the 60s. It's a comedy series. It was, and Schultz was the sergeant. It was on, ABC TV, right around the same time as F Group. You know?
What does Stalag mean?
Stalag is actually the building itself. It's like the camp. I think that's what it's called.
So the opening scene of this film, it wasn't actually an auto film. So maybe that fucks my whole entire project. I don't know. But he was in it.
That's right.
The opening scene is this prisoner of war camp, and there's these guys in this bunk, and they're trading cigarettes and shit, and they're planning an escape. So I think it's two of them. Like, okay, we're gonna go now. We're gonna do this. We're gonna escape this prisoner of war camp. So they go down this little chute that they dug out. They go outside. They, are avoiding the spotlight, and the guards. They run over to this other little cabin where they built a tunnel. They get down. They go underground through this tunnel underneath the fence. And they, get to the other side of the fence, and they're free. They start running up the hill, and then they're shot dead right there. And so I scored that scene.
Wow.
And it's like, that one also came right to me.
Yeah.
It's incredibly moving. Really dark.
And he didn't have anything, he didn't have his fingers on it at all, huh?
A singer?
No, fingers, Otto. I'm looking through my notes here.
I don't think he directed that.
Yeah. I know that he played on a couple of occasions, he played a German soldier, a Nazi soldier or something like that.
Yeah, I don't remember the remainder of that one. I don't remember what his role was in that one, actually. Yeah.
Okay, a couple others. I don't want to go track by track, but there's just some other ones I wanted to just...
You check out that... Have you seen that one, River and No Return?
Yeah.
That opening credit, I love that, man. That.
I've never seen it, but you're...
The that one was an obvious arrangement.
Really?
For me. It's like a cowboy folk song.
Wow. It's great talking to you about this, because I listen to it, and then when you say things, I'll go back and kind of go, oh, yeah. I mean, I've got pretty good ears, and I can make the connections, but it's always really good to talk to an artist like this, so I'll go back and listen to it a different way.
That theme song is great. It's like a prairie, kind of cowboyish, like, folky. I love those, those cowboy songs, I have this idea. I did some tours with this guitar player named Brandon Coleman. He's from Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
He lives in Cincy now. He's great. He's an amazing blues guitar player, too. And we've done tours like in Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, out in the shit. And he grew up playing with his dad, his Bobby, playing like Appalachian folk music.
Oh.
and we had this idea of we're gonna record a bunch of Appalachian folk murder ballads because they're great, man. And that kind of reminds me of that stuff.
Wow.
The theme song from River No Return is haunting. Yeah.
Well, the River movie has got. I read about it. I didn't watch it. I should watch it. So easy to watch movies now for free on.
Right.
Especially older movies. But Marilyn Monroe is in it.
Yeah.
It's got like kind of like a really great story.
Yeah. It's a good one. Have you seen a bunch of Otto's movies?
I've seen some over the years, like bits and pieces, but I wasn't chasing after him. You know?
I can't say that I'm a huge Otto fan.
What about Laura? That's a good film.
It's a good film. I can't say I love it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I love the song.
Yeah.
But I wasn't going to play the song, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to remember what scene I scored that. I'm trying to remember what damn song I wrote for that. I wrote a song for Laura, right?
Yeah.
Which one was that? Jesus.
You and Jason are conversing in that. Where is it?
What does that song sound like? It feels like it was 10 years ago.
When did you record it? Last year, right? Oh, this year.
June? It feels like a century ago.
You've got so much stuff going on.
Have you seen any of those Nouvelle actual physical records?
Yeah, tell me about Nouvelle. Because Ilan was telling me that basically they put it out vinyl only. And then after 2 years...
Yeah, they hand you the master.
And you can do whatever you want. So will you record it on... Will you put it out as a CD?
So I recorded for the first season.
Yeah,
he knew me. He heard me through, Frank Kimbrough's playing?
Yeah.
So Frank was on a few of my records. We used to play a lot together. And I think that Ilan, he's a pianist. Ilan's a good piano player.
Yeah.
I think he studied with Kimbrough. Maybe at Juilliard or something. And heard my playing through Frank and decided to get in touch to see if I wanted to make a record for him. So I told him I wanted to make a ballads record. And I really wanted to record with Billy Hart. I love Ben Maunder's comping. And I had never played with John Patitucci before, and I loved his playing. And so we made a record for Ilan. That between you and I can't stand.
You didn't like how it came out?
Not at all.
Why not?
Off the record, Billy, it was like he didn't have his headphones on the whole session. He played through every ending. He didn't learn any of the melodies that I, because he doesn't read. He called me a couple weeks before. He said, I know you don't want to rehearse or send me shit, but can you at least send me the melodies? So I recorded myself playing the melodies, sent it to his email address, and he never checked them out. So, which is fine, but at the session, you know, he got all, you know. Ben kind of went into his dark place like he does occasionally, and Patitucci was great. He's a special dude too, but musically it wasn't what I wanted.
Uh-huh.
So Ilan last year handed me the master and I just shelved it. I'm not going to do anything with it. This one, maybe I'll release later on, but so anyway, Ilan hit me up. I did the first record for him, and then later on he asked me if I wanted to do another one for him, and I pitched him the Preminger idea, and he loved it. And so, you know.
And so, are you able to track it? I mean, do people? I know that there's a whole vinyl
craze. Yeah.
Did you sell?
I sold every one of them.
How many did you have?
Well, I only bought maybe 30 of them off them, but you have to sell them for $50. And you can't sell them online. You have to only sell them at gigs. And how many gigs, how many times are you going to play at Smalls or Jazz Standard and sell $50 vinyl, you know?
Yeah.
So, I sold them for $50, all of them.
Huh?
Yeah.
Good for you.
I mean, they charge an arm and a leg to be a member.
Oh, they
it's
do.
Like $500 a year, and you get 6 records. It's a very upscale. You got to be a wealthy dude. But they have the members, so good for them. And they treat you exceptionally well. He doesn't fuck around. He doesn't cheap you on any part of the process.
So does he pony up the money to do the record?
Every penny.
Every penny? Even your side?
I made money on both of them.
Good for you. Good for you.
It's really, he's an artist, he understands, he really gets it. There's not one part of the process that he, you know, shortcuts. The manufacturing is beautiful, the artwork is great, the liner notes are done by a really great writer every season. He gives you full artistic, you know, leeway to do whatever you want.
So when you get the masters, can you then make more CDs that are cheaper as well as, I mean,
I can do
more
anything
LPs?
I can do whatever I want with it.
Yeah? Are you going to do more LPs?
Maybe. You know, nobody makes money selling this shit, you know.
It's a calling card, isn't it?
Expensive.
Back to New York?
I miss playing with inspiring cats.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, every day you can play with some of the best musicians in the world that inspire you.
Uh-huh.
There ain't nobody to play with in Boston except Jason. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I play with a guy named Nat McGavro every couple weeks. He played with Sonny Stitt. He played with Coleman Hawkins. He's 85.
Yeah.
I love playing with him, but he doesn't push.
Yeah.
You know, like playing with, you know, Jonathan Blake or, you know, some great drummer here. They can just go over their pad and play a session with every day.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different thing.
Yeah.
I miss that. And I feel like, you know, look, I'm clearly very conflicted. It's a difficult, this is a hard, I'm in a hard part of my career.
How so?
Because like I was saying before, I don't get any satisfaction out of the situation has to be perfect. I love traveling, but usually it's really strenuous, you know, and it's not fun. All the cards need to be perfectly lined up, and that rarely happens. You have to be able to get to that headspace on the gig, which rarely happens, where you feel actually free. That's rare. Either you're jet lagged, or you ate a bad meal, and your stomach's fucked up, or, you know, or your girlfriend's yelling at you, or you're stressed you're going to miss your flight because you can't get your saxophone on because you're in the last fucking zone, you know? Or, you know, or something's wrong musically, or the promoter's giving you a hard time. It's just like, there's always something. But more importantly, with the music, it's like, again, it has to be satisfying. And you can only play so loud, so intensely. You can only play with so much passion. And then it's cut off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the end. It doesn't go on forever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why Train died. He gave up. He lived the music, and he couldn't do anything else.
Yeah. I'm sure that'll be controversial if I put that down.
I mean, he really, really lived the music,
yeah.
You know? And I think that there wasn't anywhere else for him to go. Because
yeah.
I don't know where else there is to go.
I talked to Joe Lovano last week. Or was it earlier this week? I can't remember. No, it was last week. He's got a new record out on ECM. Comes out in February. And it's with Marilyn Crispell and this drummer who he used to play with when he was 17 and 18 in Cleveland. And it's for ECM. And it's the most it's a total different Joe Lovano than I've ever heard. And I've been following Joe Lovano since the beginning.
He's a different, he's doing something different now. We played together a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah?
Me, him, and Liebman.
What'd you do? Oh, as a saxophone summit?
No. You know, every week in Boston, there's a club called Lily Pad. And at 7 or 7.30, Berganzi plays, Gary Berganzi.
Uh-huh.
And around 10, Garzone plays with his band.
Uh-huh.
Garzone was out of town, and Liebman was in town. So Liebman called me, and Lovano also happened to be in town, so the three of us hit.
Uh-huh.
And just played free, you know, for a couple hours.
What was that?
I mean, those are my two idols. Liebman was my first saxophone teacher when I was 12.
Uh-huh.
And Lovano is one of my heroes. I love Joe.
Yeah.
He's a sweetheart. And he's...
When you hear the new ECM album, because it's so different than anything I've ever heard. I mean, it's like kind of views through and ECM, Manfred Eichert, just, he's kind of like rethinking the whole CD thing. He's just gone. And it's like, do I need to put 78 to 80 minutes on every recording? So he structured it, you know, it's on a CD, as if it were an LP. So he has side A and side B. It's pretty remarkable. It's kind of like what you're doing with
music. So is it 40 or so minutes? Is it shorter?
About 40 minutes. Brilliant. That's perfect. More, longer than that, I gotta say, I listen to a lot of music. Longer than that, I don't need. You know? I just... It's like you go to a show at a club, and you're probably going to get, you know, 60 minutes. Maybe if they really stretch it, 75. But at a certain point, you know, you're focused.
That's because nobody's got shit to say anymore. I mean, you wouldn't be saying that if you saw Miles. Or you wouldn't be saying that, you know, if you saw Train at the Half Moon. Or you wouldn't be saying that if you saw, you know, I don't know. Monk.
Yeah.
I guess.
He's not there anymore. With that in mind, you've got the Crisscross album, which is all your original, right? And who's in that band?
Rudy Royston.
Uh-huh.
His bass player, Kim Cass.
Wasn't it? Oh, the bass player on the
He's on everything, man. He's, I mean, he's like Jocko on upright, but on another level. It's another level.
Yeah.
He's like Train on an... I mean, it's like another level. So anyway, Cam plays bass. The guitar player is a really, really young guitarist that I met in Boston named Max Light.
Max Light?
Light.
L-I-G-H-T?
Yep. He's fantastic. And... I like him. I like his playing. He's a great straight edge. Tegan's. Do you know Jerry at all? Who owns Crisscross?
No, I don't.
He's a really good guy. He's been really good to me.
You've got some history with him.
No.
I thought you made. I
made two records for him. This is the second one.
Second one? Okay, good.
Jimmy Katz. I don't know if you know Jimmy at all.
Yeah, sure I do.
Jimmy recommended him to me. He called Jimmy, I guess, and said, "Do you know anyone who should make a record for me? You recommend anyone?" And Jimmy and I used to be friends, and Jimmy said, "Call Noah." So I made a record for him called Genuinity a year and a half ago or so.
Yeah.
And Jerry and I hit it off. I think he appreciated my honesty, and I appreciated his honesty. You know, Jerry's the only record I've recorded for five record labels. He's the only record label owner that has given me money after I made a date for him. At my second session for this record, he showed up with a wad of cash. He said, "This is for your compositions." I said, "What are you doing, man? Giving me more money?" You know, that was after he already paid for everything. You know, I mean, he's a sincere cat. I really like him. I appreciate him, man. He's one of a kind. So So anyway, so yeah, Rudy Kim is the bassist, Max, and Jason Palmer is the trumpet player.
Sure. You use him a lot too, right?
I like Jason.
Yeah.
Jerry Teagan said to me, he said, I want you to make another record for me. I said, okay, I'd love to, you know. He said, who do you want to use? And I said, I really like Rudy. I actually called Bill Stewart first. I never played with Bill. He couldn't make it. So I called Rudy, who I like too. I called Kim, who Jerry loves. He said, do you know any guitar players? I said, not really, man. You know, I love Ben Maunder, and all the rest of them kind of sound the same. He said, well, do you know anyone who's really straight ahead? I said, look, this is guitar player. He's really young, named Max Light. You'll like him. And I, you know, I think that you really, you dig him. He said, okay, call him. And he said, can you call Jason again? I really love Jason's playing. I said, well, I'd like to make a quartet record for you. He said, that's cool, but I love Jason, so can you call him?
So he did a quintet.
You know, he's the boss, you know?
Yeah, sure. It's nice to have that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Which is rare. It used to be, that's the way you used to do business.
Yeah, I mean, I love Jason, so it's not like I care, you know. And so, I have really fucked up existential anxiety. I mean, not, I don't have a fear of dying, but, you know, what happens after, and, you know, I'm a very visual person, so seeing, you know, like, seeing the people I love and care about, or meeting you and seeing you, and one day I won't have that. One day, everything will just, it'll be done, you know. And I'm not a religious person. I believe in, you know, we're worm food. And so, I thought that it would be an interesting, maybe it would help me personally, psychologically, to make a record where I came up with these descriptions of these worlds that we may go to after we die. It's totally like, you know, some sci-fi shit. So I wrote these ideas down, and then I composed for those songs. And then one of my, like, this woman who's like a second mother to me, named Ruth Lepson, really great poet, agreed to take those descriptions and write beautiful, more beautiful descriptions of these worlds. So she's working on it now. But so I wrote these songs based on these different worlds that we may end up in.
And are they going to be sung?
No. No.
It's going to be in the liner notes.
It's just the liner notes.
Yeah. Wow, that's kind of cool.
It's just to help me with, you know, coping.
And did it help?
No.
Writing music, it didn't help?
No. You know, we're going to die, man. You know, I'm scared fucking shitless. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going to happen. It's terrifying. You're not terrified? Are you religious?
Yeah, I kind of am, yeah. I don't know what it's going to be like on the other side. I'm a Christian. You know, practicing Christian, an evangelical Christian, no. But that's kind of like, that's my worldview. And I believe. But, you know, I saw my dad about a year ago. He went. He was 94. My mom's 90. She's, I don't know if she's going to make it another year. She's got dementia. She's got, she's already fallen once.
She's 90?
Yeah. Well, she turns 90 next week.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, yeah, where do they go? Do I hope to see them on the other side? It'd be great. My grandmother, who died a number of years ago, I would love to see her on the other side. But I don't know if that's what it's going to be. You know, it's all about, you don't know. You have faith that something better is going to be around it. That's what I believe. But what it is, and it's all faith, too, anyways, because you don't know. You don't know. There's no, like, okay, stage one, and then you go into stage two, it's all set up for you. That's what, at least to, you know, to my Christian sensibility of things, that's what it's all about. It's faith that things will be better. I know they will be better. So what's the name of this album?
I don't know yet. I was thinking about calling it After We're Gone, but we won't be gone. We're going to another world. And also, it sounds like that other song, After You've Gone, which I love to play. I'm not sure. I'm going to figure it out when I see what she writes.
Yeah.
I might pull from there.
So this is coming out in March?
I think so, yeah. I'm mixing it on Friday, so...
My deadline is 2nd of January.
I'll get you the music.
Anything you can
I'll get you as much as I can by then.
Yeah. That way I'll cover as many of the bases as I can. Okay, I want to talk to you about...
You need another beer or you good?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Dead Composers Club.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that. The thinking behind it and how you pulled that off and what that was like. Was that a passionate thing?
Yeah. They're all passion projects, man, because, you know, Rob Garcia is one of my best friends.
Uh-huh.
He's a really, really one-of-a-kind drummer. I mean, he grew up, I don't know if you're familiar with any of his stuff.
Nope.
Robbie grew up playing trad jazz. And, he plays, you know, Vince Giordano in the Nighthawks? He plays with Vince so often in that band. But he's also a really great contemporary jazz drummer. He plays with everybody. He's unique. And he has, I mean, he's a really, really unique player. And I love it. I love him and I love his playing. And so one night, I was checking out Chopin's music, which I had never checked out. I was late to the game with classical. And I was also late to the game with blues. I mean, I did a couple blues records, which I really, you know, adore. But I was late to the game with classical music, so a few years ago I was checking out Chopin's preludes, the Rubinstein preludes. And it was like late at night, and I was like, wow. I called Rob around 1 or 2 in the morning. I said, this music plays itself. We need to record it, you and I. I would love to do a project with you. You know, I played in his band. We did maybe 4 or 5 records under his name. I always wanted to do a project with him because he's an innovator. He has just great ideas. And I thought it'd be fun. You know, I love him. So he said, I'm in. Whatever you want to do, man. So I sent him a bunch of the music that I liked. He picked out 4 or 5 songs he loved. I picked out 4 or 5 songs I loved. I said, why don't we just start a band together called the Dead Composers Club and just record music every year that people, you know, some composer who's dead that we admire, and arrange the music and have fun with it, you know? So Kim Cass, the bass player, I don't know if you're familiar with Nate Radley. Great guitar player. He's married to Chris Davis, a pianist. So anyway, Nate's a guitar player. He's great. He's kind of in the Frizzell vein, but he sounds like himself. So, blast, man. Jimmy Katz recorded it. Jimmy recorded 4 or 5 of my records the past couple years.
What label did that come out
of? Rob, what label is that? He co-owns a label, a nonprofit called, not Brooklyn Jazz Underground, oh, it's called Connection Works. They have a jazz series in Brooklyn. So it's under that label.
Uh-huh.
Self-release.
Yeah. So that was last year. What's this year? You thought about it?
Yeah. We're stuck. If Rob doesn't want to do it, I'll do it on my own. Are you familiar with Hildegard von Bingen's music?
Hildegard who?
Von Bingen?
No.
She's like an 11th century nun who wrote unbelievable vocal music. If you take a history of Western music course, that's day one. She's incredible. She was a rebel for her time.
And her music got passed down through the years?
Yeah. It's really moving. beautiful music. And so I thought, man, and you know, the way that music was composed back then is very different than now. You know, it's not like flats and sharps, and you know, the whole thing is a different system. So there's a lot. It's endless, the ideas that you come up with in terms of arranging those compositions. So I wanted to do that. I don't know if Rob's sold on it. So we were either going to do that or Zappa.
Oh, Zappa.
Zappa would be fun.
Zappa would be good.
So,
I interviewed him.
Really?
Yeah, like a month before he died. Last interview. It's a thrill. It's one of the thrills of my life to interview Zappa in his house.
I spent days watching interviews with him. He's brilliant.
He's brilliant. The guy's brilliant. A friend of mine out of San Francisco who writes books says, Dan, you need to write about Zappa in the last 10 years of his life, what he was doing. Because he knew that I had interviewed him. So I said, I don't know if I could do that. Because there's a lot of his classical music at that point. With reference to his earlier stuff. So it's kind of like in the back of my mind. But I've got this great... I did it for Tower Pulse when they used to have that magazine. They would give out free. And they... I was writing for them and they asked me to do a cover story. It was touch and go. I was living in San Francisco at the time and I had in-laws living down in L.A. So I'd go down there and just kind of wait to hear if it was a good day or a bad day.
For the interview.
I spent 5 hours with him. It was cool.
Where was he living?
He lived in Hollywood Hills.
Wow.
Yeah, Zappa would be great.
That'd be fun. But, you know, the Hildegard thing.
That would be... I never heard of it.
You gotta check her out, man. It's special.
Okay.
What?
This is an unusual question, but it comes... It's an obvious question, but it comes from my editor, who lives in the Midwest in Chicago. He says, talk about music and politics. I just went, oh, baby, here we go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So... I'm a news junkie.
You're what?
A news junkie.
What do you read?
I mean, I stream MSNBC on my phone, and unfortunately, I watch CNN.
CNN's great.
It's okay.
Do you go to Politico?
I read Politico.
Yeah? Do you get their newsletter? Every morning, I get a newsletter. If you go to Politico, they'll say, like, you know, get a newsletter every morning. And it just, it's kind of the headlines with a little bit. It's got links to different things. Politico's great. That's true. That's the nice thing.
So my phone, every morning I wake up, I turn on CNN on my phone. You know, I take a shower and I watch the show. I mean, I'm bad. I have a fucking problem. and then, you know, I have a Samsung, and so it, whatever the news source is on the phone, it, you know, different ones pop up. So I get Fox, I get MSNBC, I mean, I get the whole gamut, you know, which I like. But it's mainly MSNBC. What's that one? I sort of like, it's three numbers.
Three numbers?
You know what I mean. Like 369 or 598.
I don't know.
That one.
I don't know.
I like that one too. It's very left-leaning though. You know. Anyway. MSNBC is great. I like Rachel Maddow.
Oh, God.
You know. So anyway, I mean, obviously I hate Donald Trump. And he was elected, and for that record, instead of being like a real protest record, I thought it'd be fun to make a record to celebrate the freedoms that we may be in fear of losing. So like climate change, and so I wrote a song called Mother Earth. You know, just as like something to, I don't know. And then release it on Inauguration Day. So that's what I did for that one. And we turned that record around. I mean, Jimmy recorded that. We did it in like a couple weeks.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we came up with the idea together, and then 2 weeks later, we recorded it. I wrote the music in 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks after that, it was manufactured now. It was within a month. Fast.
That turned the dial for you, right?
How so?
Well, people paid attention to
it. I have a weird career, man.
How so?
Today my inbox had emails from Jazz's, Downbeat, and Jazz Times on one, you know, portion of the, you know. So critics seem to like what I do. Every record has gotten great reviews. I'm one of the top records of the year. Every single year I put out a record. But my straw is not the one that's drawn for work. I don't work. It's fascinating. And so I don't have the opportunities to play. Like someone like a Dana Stevens or a Melissa Aldana or a Tia Fuller or Branford or like Joe, you know. So I can't really, I have limitations in terms of these people get to play with, and I'm not complaining, it's just how life works, you know. So these other people have the opportunity to play with wonderful drummers on a regular basis, travel and get to play. And for me, it's a different path, which I'm okay with. So, anyway, I don't know why we started, we got on that subject, but politics. You know, every generation, I've had the opportunity. I'm lucky that I got to play with a lot of older musicians. I got to play in like Cecil McBee's bands, you know, with like people like George Cables and Eddie Henderson and that, and Victor Lewis. I play with Billy Hart. I have friends with Lee Konitz. You know, people, a lot of like older, and they've all said every generation there are people that nobody understands why they're working. They work a lot, nobody gets it. In every generation, there's people who should be working, but they're not, and nobody gets it. And you have the prodigies in every generation, and you have the people who are really old and shouldn't be working, but they still do, because there's that stuff. You know, it's a thing. You see it, you write about them. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I mean, the fact that I pitched a story on you and I got a green light, that's, let's see what happens. I mean, you were, was it Critics' Poll or was it Reader's Poll? It must have been the Critics' Poll.
Yeah, I won it.
Yeah.
I won like Rising Star or something.
Yeah.
For the critics.
Yep. So,
every time my name is mentioned, I'm grateful. Extremely. So anyway,
so back to politics.
Back to politics.
Does it infuse your music other than just this record? Or is that, like you're talking about wanting to have passion and things, is that inform your passion at all?
No, not musically. It makes you want to do good for others. You know, it makes you want to it makes me want to work with less fortunate people. So I've done certain outreach things in Boston with, you know, I teach a bunch of kids for free. I have a student whose dad just lost his job, and I teach the mom and the son for free. You know, like, when I see someone like Trump treat poor people like shit and take away their health care or try to, and shit like that, it just makes me want to do better for people. And so it's mainly a teaching thing with teaching. You know, it makes me want to, inspire people.
Cool.
Yeah. Not necessarily musically. I mean, maybe I play more passionately if I'm pissed, you know? But, you know, that record was a lot of fun to make, you know? So.
I think we're good?
Cool.
58 minutes, wait, 58 minutes?
Yeah.
Less time for me to transcribe. So I got to transcribe this, and hopefully I can hear it.
Cool.
But,
I do the same thing with my radio show. It's blessed. When I interview
your
people.
Radio.
I should be interviewing you, man.
You should. Hey.
Another time.
Interview me.
Cool.
Me, really. I would love to.
Okay, cool. Another time.
To say. Maybe not the most. Yeah. My take on the. Jazz scene is kind of mixed, you know?
You don't seem like you're so, I don't know. You don't seem content with the way things are going.
No, I like writing about people. Hey, Coltrane, Monk, Miles. I've written about them all. I didn't meet any of them. I love them. But you know what? It's over. Let's look at people who are young, who are taking the music forward, and who have important things to say. You know? Let me make sure I get this right. That's my take on things.
So who's moving it forward?